Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Today we have with us Matt Morris. Thank you for being here today, Matt.
Happy to be here.
So Matt, you are a little different than the typical guests we've had so far on the show. You're not a just regular old data scientist and coming up with a model or actually implementing, let's say, the technical solution to some problem with data science or machine learning. Can you tell us a little bit about what is your role and what that sort of means?
Sure. Well, first off, I'm still a scientist, and I look at data every day, but I don't really consider myself a data scientist. What I am is a geoscientist. My background is in geophysics, so I took an undergrad and a graduate degree in geophysics, so it's my job to understand how the world is put together. And then I make maps of the subsurface, and I make recommendations as to where we drill wells so we can turn oil into money.
What is your title exactly?
So I'm a geophysical advisor at Anadarko.
So you sort of advise on different problems and projects, and you're kind of monitoring the output, let's say, of different models that are used for them. Is that kind of fair to say?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a big part of that, at least for your role, is in, let's say, verifying the output of, let's say, a neural network. Or some whatever machine learning model somebody wants to use. And you have, is it fair to say, quite a bit of experience in that particular part of it, which maybe for a typical data scientist, they're maybe not quite as focused on that aspect. They might be more into, you know, architecting the actual model and how many layers and such. But is it fair to say you're more focused on actually verifying the output gives you what you want and does the job well? And
right, yeah. So the data scientist might call me a domain expert, right? And so, you know, their background is in statistics and maybe more niche applications like machine learning. But my job is to be the guardrails for those data scientists. So first and foremost, I help them prioritize what sort of projects are going to be useful for the company to help us solve problems. And second of all, once they do come up with a solution, it's my job to make sure it's realistic and it conforms with the laws of geology and the laws of physics and make sure it's going to be valid.
What problems are solvable with machine learning and data scientists? You have to think of the different problems to apply to. What problems are solvable? Is it every problem? Is it almost none of them in between?
Well, there's lots of problems that don't need deep learning. We've got lots of science, lots of equations, and lots of code where the problem is more or less solved. But what deep learning does for us is it expands the bounds of computational problems. So to me, these are fuzzier problems where I know the answer when I see it. And I might not know how to write code to make a computer do it automatically, but if I show the computer enough examples, then these deep learning algorithms can sort of wire themselves up and detect features more like a person can.
That's a great way to put it. And you've had some problems recently that you've applied these to that have been solved that you might have even been a little surprised about, that you thought maybe it wouldn't be able to do it, but the machine learning models were able to. So for instance, can you explain this rock slide problem, what exactly this was that you did recently?
Sure, yeah. This is one of those pattern-seeking problems that geologists have been spending lots of their career doing. So what we're doing is we're looking for mass transport complexes in seismic data. So a mass transport complex is a pretty straightforward thing to understand. It's like an underground rock slide. And so if you're a bug living on the ocean floor when this happens, it's a really bad day. So when these things occur, we get massive mass wasting. And all of these mud and rock and sediments start sliding down the hill in a landslide. And that creates a void space. And a lot of times these void spaces fill up with reservoir sands. And so often our ability to map these mass transport complexes, or MTCs, helps us explore for oil and gas accumulations. So this is a pattern in the data. I don't really know how to write code to automatically detect an MTC, but I know one when I see one. So what we did is we showed the computer a bunch of examples of what mass transport complexes look like in seismic data, and we turned it loose. And I'll tell you what, I didn't think it was going to work, but I was pretty surprised. The deep learning technique actually did pretty well. At least it exceeded my expectations. Now, what it needs is it needs some guardrails. It needs someone to sit down in front of the machine's prediction and QC it. Because it truly doesn't understand what a mass transport complex is. What it's doing is it's looking for particular patterns in the data that tend to be associated with mass transport complexes, and when it finds them, it flags them.
And so this data, just one more time, this is all seismic data that this was used on. And this is going to essentially be some kind of like image of the subsurface.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And so these MTCs, these rock slide, whatever you want to call them, patterns, they have just sort of certain qualities to them in the seismic data image that can be a little bit tough to figure out exactly what that looks like and figure out how to detect that.
Right. Yeah, they're chaotic. They have a bizarre pattern. They're not very conformable. And so it's the exact sort of problem where we don't have any good auto-tracking technologies off the shelf that we can use to detect these things.
Mm-hmm.
These things tend to be anomalies or exceptions to the data. And so it's the sort of thing that it's just a perfect fit for what machine learning is good at and what traditional algorithms are not good at.
And why were you a little bit unsure at first whether it would work, say, as well as it did once it was all finished?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a really what I call a fuzzy problem, right? This isn't a very discrete feature. It's somewhat subjective. You might, if you gave this to a handful of geologists, you might get a handful of different answers back. So it's just the sort of problem that I thought there was just way too much ambiguity for an ML or a deep learning based approach to solve it. So I was pleasantly surprised when our first iteration, our first proof of concept, returned some good results.
Uh-huh. What exactly was the way that you solved, or whoever it was that implemented the actual software solution, the machine learning solution, what was the final?
Right. Yeah, we've been having a lot of good success with convolutional neural networks and applying those to seismic data. And so the specific flavor that we're using here is an encoder-decoder-based architecture. And that seems to be a pretty robust approach because we can use it for mass transport complexes. We can use it for other features that we see in the seismic, like channels or faults.
Mm-hmm. And so the neural network, it basically just feed an image in some seismic data, and it'll pretty much tell you either yes or no, whether there's an MTC present or not.
That's right. We feed it raw seismic data, and then we provide labels on top of that seismic data. So the machine wires itself up to learn what the patterns are underneath the labels.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can predict or detect the presence or absence of a particular feature.
Mm-hmm. And there was another kind of maybe similar project that you were talking about. Again, some image data you wanted to sharpen up some images, and I think this was seismic data again. Do you mind telling
Sure.
us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, again, this is seismic data, and what we were doing was applying a generative adversarial network to our data. Because what we were finding is the seismic data in its raw form was not particularly sharp, and the features that we were trying to detect in the data were coming out sort of fuzzy. And we wanted a sharper and more crisp feature detection network. And so it turned out that the answer was to use a sharpening technique that's based on GANs, or generative adversarial networks. So we passed our seismic data through the GAN, and the output of this technique is much more denser sampled seismic data set. So now when we go to detect features on this sharper and more densely sampled data set, we get a much sharper feature resolved from our prediction.
What would be some of these features that you're trying to extract
well,
out of it?
Yeah, when we published on this technique, we were chiefly focused on trying to sharpen up our fault image. But it's a very generalizable technique. We can actually apply it to any sort of feature that we want to try to sharpen up.
Okay, very interesting. So you, I don't know if this is fair to say, have an area of expertise on measuring the quality of all of these models. Again, a lot of people maybe focus more, especially I'd say right now, on getting into the actual crafting of a neural network. How many layers? What do you set everything to actually get it to solve some problem, maybe give you like a yes or no answer on some question, or give you some feature back with some high accuracy. And you spend a lot of time at the end part of the pipeline of actually making sure it is solving the problem in the way that you want it to solve the problem. Do you mind telling us about that? Is that fair to say this is a bit more of your area, and how do you then do that? How do you measure the quality of these answers that you get out at the end of the day?
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's an expertise of mine, but it is an interest. So after we get these neural network predictions back, it's my job to sort of judge their quality and determine if they're going to help us in our search for oil. So there's some very simple and standard ways to measure the output of a network, and these are generally just statistical methods. Some of them are called precision and recall, and essentially they're point counts. So you measure, you count all the true positives, you count all the true negatives, and then you ratio them to say something about how intelligent your network is at detecting a feature.
And that's just if you have basically some question of a yes or no, or just classify this, let's say, as an MTC, like you mentioned before, or not as an MTC.
Yeah, that's a real good point, because all you're doing is saying whether or not a feature is detected or not,
mm-hmm.
right? It doesn't really say anything about the character or the quality of the feature itself. So what I'm trying to do is go a little bit deeper. So I'm thinking about what sort of other statistical methods could we apply to our detections to measure the quality of these. And so one of the techniques that we stumbled upon in literature is something called a Hartigan's dip statistic. So this was a technique that was published in the 80s, and it's essentially trying to measure how bimodal a distribution is. Because what we really want is a distribution that's all very much yeses or very much nos without a lot of hedging in between. So essentially what that should look like if you plot up its distribution is a whole bunch of zeros and a whole bunch of ones in a probability field. What you don't want is a bunch of fence sitting at 0.5, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if we have a bunch of ones and a bunch of zeros, we should have a very sharp image. And so Hartigan's dip statistic is just a way to measure how much bimodality we have, or how steep the edges are of the zeros and one populations.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a statistic. It's just a tool to try to quantify something that we can all sort of agree on, whether a feature is fuzzy or sharp.
That's interesting. I don't know if I'd ever even really thought about that before. So when the quality or the character of the answer itself versus just the answer. So do you actually have the model trained with that put into it, where during the training process, when it's looking at all the examples, not only is it being tested to see how accurate it is, but also you will like implement in the dip statistic during the training process?
Boy, I'd like to say yes, but we're just not there yet. Right now, it's just something I compute, I look at, and then I go back to my data scientists and say, hey, you know what? This isn't really good enough. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to reach parity with what an expert can do. So there's another way we can measure the output of a neural network and try to measure its quality, and that's applying a Turing test. So you've probably heard of a Turing test. That's a test you can administer to try to confuse a person as to whether they're interacting with a human or a machine. So we could sort of extend that analogy to a neural network output, because what I would say is that ultimately what we're trying to do here is reach parity with what our experts are doing when they're interpreting seismic data.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can develop a machine's output that looks just like an expert's output, I think that's probably the ultimate benchmark that we're trying to
mm-hmm.
achieve.
Yeah.
And so how do you do that? Well, I don't really have any clever statistical tools
right.
to do it,
right.
but what I can do is put down a machine's interpretation in front of an expert and ask them if it looks like it was done by a human or a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can start fooling the experts who are responsible for creating these interpretations, I think we've really hit a pretty serious milestone in our research here.
Mm-hmm. So the way that it's done today, is that kind of the final step of the process? You just put it in front of a human and maybe ask a few questions. What do you think of this? Does this look about right?
That's precisely what we do. I mean, statistics is great and all, but really what we're trying to do is try to amplify an expert's abilities. So the technique here is that we train on 1 or 2% of the seismic data
mm-hmm.
based on experts' labels,
mm-hmm.
and then the machine handles the other 99% of the data to try to amplify that person's expertise. So when the machine's output looks just like the person's expertise, I think we're done. I think we've got a viable product there.
So right now it's kind of like a multi-step with this, because all three of these things that you've described are not all put just into one actual automated process where you get all three and you're done. So first you make sure you get the, let's say, precision recall, and that you can just make sure when you're training, let's say, a neural network. And then for things like the quality of the answer, like the dip statistic, you might just look at it and ask if there's a way to tune the network after where you've seen some of the answers to get it to look a little bit different. And then finally, you might just say, this doesn't look quite how it should, and this is not quite human level.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, ultimately what we're trying to do is influence decisions, right? So we're at an office at an oil company. The real money is made out in the field when we drill wells. So what we're trying to do is trying to wring as much insight out of the data as we possibly can. And there's an awful lot of data sets in the oil field where there's just so much data, it's not really possible for an expert to look at all of it. So we're offloading a lot of that knowledge work to a machine. And in order for us to really rely or be able to believe in the decisions we make, we need to have some amount of trust that these neural networks are at parity with what the experts are doing.
That wraps up the first part. Thank you very much, Matt.